Wednesday was a good day for the markets.
All three indexes, Dow, S&P, NASDAQ, on track for their best day in 7 years.
1,100 points for the biggest one-day point gain ever.
Ever. Did I mention those gains came 2 days after this?
Because you had a bad day, you take it one down.
This is the worst December for U.S. stocks since the Great Depression in the 1930s.
Stocks took a huge tumble on the shortened Christmas Eve trading day.
And lately, we've been hearing some people talking about the R word.
Big, big concern for 2019 about a recession.
Glass half empty.
We actually see the recession odds.
60%.
Does that mean a recession is coming?
It's not there quite. It's getting closer. I see that.
We're going to make sense of what you should and shouldn't be worried about when it comes to your money. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. I've got two guests with me now to help try and figure some of this out. Chris Farrell is a senior economics contributor at Marketplace. Welcome to The Takeaway, Chris.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure. And Campbell Harvey is a professor of finance at Duke University. Thanks for being with us, Campbell.
Great to be on the show.
Chris, let's start with you. The stock market is not the same as the economy. And in the economy, there have been some bright spots. We've seen consumer spending is high. Unemployment is below 4%. So what is going on? We keep hearing this news that's coming out of the stock market that everything's negative.
So what the stock market's trying to do is anticipate, or investors really are trying to do, is anticipate what lies in our future, what's ahead, because you're absolutely right. For the typical person, the typical worker, what really matters is the unemployment rate. That's 3.7%. And then if you want to look at financial assets, it's not the stock market. It's housing that matters, and housing has slowed down. But this volatility, this concern with the stock market, the discussion about the recession, this is all about trying to figure out what lies in our future, because the evidence, I think, is fairly clear that the economy is starting to slow down, and that raises the question, by how much?
And we've seen these huge swings up and down. We're hearing whispers about a recession. The markets rallied yesterday. I mean, how do we make sense of any of this? Because I think most Americans, I know I am having whiplash trying to keep up, Chris.
Right. And this is what the professionals do. This is what people like Campbell Harvey do in terms of trying to figure out what is going on here. For the typical person, look, you have to step back. You have to say, look, job market's still good. You know, my housing is holding its value fairly well. And in terms of what the stock market is doing, we've had this enormous fiscal stimulus, which was the tax cut. And the tax cut came into this economy. It boosted growth, I'm rounding off the numbers, from 2% to 3%. Now it appears that tax cut effect is fading, and we're going back down somewhere around 2%. But keep watching that job market. As of right now, the job market remains strong.
Campbell, I want to turn to you right now. NPR's Planet Money calls you the OG yield curve whisperer, and we're going to talk a little bit about what that means. But I'm wondering if you can help us understand why or should Americans be putting a lot of emphasis on what they see in this whiplash day-to-day activities of the stock market?
So the stock market is a classic false prophet of what is going to happen in the economy. It is predicted 9 of the last 4 recessions accurately. So there's a huge amount of noise in the stock market. Nevertheless, when volatility picks up, and we've seen volatility triple over the last year, that is not good news. So it means that there's additional uncertainty in the economy. People that are investing in the stock market, managers, uncertain as to what will happen next. And that induces risk. That induces second thinking about investments, about hiring in the future. So it's definitely not good news, but we need to be careful because it delivers a lot of false signals.
So let's talk about you talk about the 4 economic horsemen. The first one is this sort of volatility, right? The up, the down, the swing, the back, the forth. What are the other 3?
Yeah. So volatility, as I said, is not good news. It means risk is increased, and it can lead to decreased economic activity. So the other, I call them the four horsemen of the next recession. Number two is the result of the Duke CFO survey, a survey that's been going on for almost 25 years. And last week we released the numbers, and it was striking that 50% of CFOs thought a recession would start in 2019, and 82% believe that it will start by 2020. So they're definitely thinking recession. Number three is essentially the anti- trade sort of policies that are happening in the world are now taking effect. So last year it was just bluster, and now we can actually see the effect. I'm not just talking about the U.S. and China. Perhaps the biggest example of this is what will happen in Europe with Brexit. And I don't know, you put all of this together, and the very last one, the fourth horseman, is the yield curve.
Now that's your thing, right? You're the OG yield curve whisperer. Now, for those of us who did not go to and study the depth of economics, including me, what is a yield curve? Why does it matter? And what are you whispering to us about, Campbell?
So this is the idea that usually a longer-term interest rate, let's say a 10-year bond, the yield on that is higher than a short-term interest rate, like a treasury bill. But in certain times, that relation gets reversed. And that's when the short rate is higher than the long rate, and it's called an inverted yield curve. My dissertation at the University of Chicago in 1986 demonstrated that that preceded recessions by 12 to 18 months. And in contrast to the stock market, it didn't deliver any false signals. And indeed, after my dissertation was published, it has continued to be a reliable indicator, including a prediction of the global financial crisis.
But you know what, Campbell? Recession. The thing is, yield curve isn't as sexy as recession, I think, right? When we're talking about that in terms of economic understanding. I want to pivot for a minute to Chris here, because Chris, we talked on Wednesday's show about rising interest rates and specifically the economy and the housing market. You mentioned that at the top of the show. What role does the Fed play as a check on the economy, Chris?
So there's been this huge debate. So the Fed has been raising its interest rates. And a lot of this turmoil dates back to the last two increases in its fundamental interest rate that the Fed has done. And you know what? This has been well signaled. This is well known. And the Fed has been very clear about what it is doing. And there's this fundamental debate about whether they should be doing it or not doing it, considering inflation's tame and let's go with this low unemployment rate. What has sort of changed this discussion is the Trump effect. And Trump has raised the level of uncertainty. And so he's made this whole increase by the Fed that they well signaled in their interest rate all about him. And that Trump effect, I think that might be the fifth horseman of the concerns that Campbell Harvey is raising, is that the Fed, that Trump has made the Fed move highly controversial and made it about him. And so therefore, this increase in the Fed's rate that was well signaled and would have had some effect has had a much more dramatic effect than you would have expected.
I want to pivot a minute there to Campbell, because we were talking about the yield effect here, Campbell. But we know that our economy operates in cycles, as we've seen. We've been out of a recession since 2009. Is it just a matter of time until the economy contracts? Is that what your research is showing us?
Yeah, so we know the cycles, but the cycles, the length of the cycles is variable. So there's an asymmetry that's very interesting, that when you're in a recovery, it's incredibly difficult to forecast when the recession will start. Right now, we're 114 months since the trough of the last recession. And that's long compared to historically, the average is 58 months. So we're past due, but it's very difficult to actually call that turning point. In contrast, when you're in a recession, it's very easy to figure out a decent forecast of when you're going to come out because they're fairly short.
I want to get in one more question here, though, before we wrap. We've got about 30 seconds left. People are probably worried about their 401ks. Chris, do you have any last thoughts on that?
Look, you can't control this, what's going to happen to the stock market, but you can look at your household. Too much debt? Reduce your debt. So do what you can control, your household finances. As far as the stock market, leave that to the pros.
Chris, yeah, those were Campbell, your thoughts on that. 401ks, we've got 30 seconds.
Yeah, de-risk. So this is the time to make sure your savings account is well supplied.
Chris Farrell is a senior economics contributor at Marketplace, and Campbell Harvey, who we just heard, is a professor of finance at Duke University. Chris and Campbell, thanks for helping us understand a little bit more about the economy.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Eight-year-old Felipe Gomez Alonso died on Christmas Eve in U.S. custody. What follows is a timeline of what happened, according to Customs and Border Protection. December 18th. At 1 p.m., Felipe and his father, Agustin Gomez, are apprehended 4 miles east of the Paso del Norte port of entry in El Paso, Texas. They had traveled from Guatemala. 2 days later, they are transferred to El Paso Border Patrol Station. December 22nd. Felipe and Agustin are transferred again, this time to Alamogordo Border Patrol Station in New Mexico because of overcrowding. December 24th, 9 a.m. According to CBP, an agent notices Felipe's coughing and has glassy eyes. 30 minutes later, Agustin and Felipe are taken to a nearby hospital. 12:45 p.m. Felipe is diagnosed with a common cold and given Tylenol. 1:20 p.m. Felipe is evaluated for release but found to have a fever of 103 degrees and held for further observation. 2:50 p.m. Felipe is released from the ER with a prescription for ibuprofen and the antibiotic amoxicillin, and he and his father are taken to a temporary holding facility on Highway 70. 7 p.m. Felipe vomits. Agents help clean it up. The CBP account says Agustin declines further medical treatment for his son. 10 p.m. Felipe seems lethargic and nauseous. Border control agents take him back to the hospital. By the time the child arrives at the hospital at 11:07 p.m., he is unconscious. 31 minutes after that, at 11:48 p.m., medical staff declare 8-year-old Felipe Gomez Alonso dead. It's the second time a migrant child has died in federal custody in a matter of weeks. In both cases, the fathers have said their children were healthy before arriving at the border. Here to help us understand the dangers that children face at the border is Dr. Marcia Griffin, a professor of pediatrics who studied conditions in Customs and Border Protection custody for children. Marcia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What is the medical protocol for migrants? Is there some sort of Doctors Without Borders, ironically, at the border right now? What is the first sort of line of defense for migrants?
The Doctors Without Borders, in fact, is on the border, but they cannot operate within the United States. They are in Mexico, and they see some migrants across the border. The number that we're seeing crossing the border or asking for asylum has risen in the last couple of months. So the first actual screen of the children and the families happens when they turn themselves in to Border Patrol. So once they get into Border Patrol custody, they're taken to the processing center, and medical staff there are just cursory screening these as they come in, and they generally ask, do you have a fever, any other symptoms, any rashes? And if they say no and they appear well, they are passed through, unless the patient has symptoms and is able to notify someone.
Are there doctors doing this, or are these nurses, or you know, what level of medical personnel are we talking about here that potentially this child and other families may have come into contact with?
No, they're not doctors on site. There are EMS workers, emergency medical crews, or physician assistants or nurses who are screening them. They're not physicians, and none of them have been trained in pediatric care.
I'm just stunned when you said that. I'm speaking with Dr. Marcia Griffin, and we're talking about the latest death of a child in federal custody on our southern border. Customs and Border Protection says that in the time that Felipe and his father were in custody, there were around 24 wellness checks conducted. At the same time, this child was moved around from one facility to another. Border agents noticed that Felipe had flu-like symptoms. He was taken to a hospital. He was given amoxicillin and ibuprofen. He was released. At what point, in your expert opinion here, should something more have been done? Were there any holes in the timeline that we read?
No, I don't believe so. And they did have access to medical care by taking them to the hospital. The fact that they were being moved frequently has something to do with it. It's hard to keep up with people and how they're feeling when they're constantly being moved. So they went to the hospital. They were evaluated. I wasn't in the emergency room, so I don't know all that went on there. The problem is that the hospital emergency room staff in any of these towns along the border, they don't know the conditions within these processing centers. So if a child came into our ER and we treated them and we felt like they were stable enough to discharge, our discharge is based when your pediatrician or people who's used to dealing with children expects that that parent is taking that child home, is going to monitor them during the night. They're going to make sure they wake up periodically and take fluids. It's quite different when they're discharged and they go back to the processing center and sleep in a cold, cold room on the floor with a thin pallet and a Mylar blanket, which is simply foil over you, and there's nobody checking.
Doctor, we mentioned that in response to Felipe's death, this is the second death of a child. The first was Jacqueline, who we spoke about a couple weeks ago. Customs and Border Protection are now saying that they're going to conduct, quote, secondary medical checks on children. Do we have a sense of what that means, and do you think that is enough?
I'm not sure exactly, because they haven't defined what that really is. The leaders of the Academy of Pediatrics have spoken with the leaders of Customs and Border Protection actually yesterday about offering our help in designing protocols and other things and really opening up a conversation. And I'm very encouraged by that. However, the medical screening or having secondary screenings needs to be done with someone who's trained in pediatric care. A child can go south or can get seriously complicated or worse in a very short time. They're not little adults. So somebody has to know to be looking for a rapid heart rate, increased breathing, or decreased capillary refill, or sunken fontanelles in an infant. They have to know what to look for, because once a child has become severely dehydrated, they're seriously compromised.
We should mention that we did reach out to the Gerald Champion Regional Medical Center where Felipe was treated, but a spokeswoman declined to comment because of patient privacy. I should also add that we reached out to Customs and Border Protection for further comment, but they did not return our request for comment. Dr. Marcia Griffin is a pediatrician who focuses on immigration with the American Academy of Pediatrics. Doctor, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you very much.
If you've got a pile of get-rich-quick and find-love-now guides piling up in anticipation of the new year, well, you're not alone. The so-called self-improvement market was worth a whopping $9.9 billion in 2016. That includes everything from personal coaching to weight loss programs to self-help books. And my next two guests, well, they have a little experience in this area.
Every season, we live by 8 books, and we live by each book for 2 weeks at a time. We're currently about halfway through our 4th season of the show, so that means we've lived by over 30 books so far, right?
Yes.
Am I doing my math wrong?
I don't know. I didn't do any of the math. I was going to lean on you for that mental math.
Jolenta Greenberg and Kristen Meinzer are co-hosts of By the Book, a podcast that's half self-help advice and half social experiment. So as we head into 2019, I asked Kristen and Jolenta to walk me through the best and worst advice that they followed for their show. And we began with one book they could both get behind.
Well, I think Jolenta and I agree on one book very much that we both took something away from, and that was Zero Waste Home by Bea Johnson. Going into it, I think, Jolenta, thinking that we already were doing a pretty good job as far as our personal practices. We both recycle. Neither of us own a car.
But I figured growing up in Portland, Oregon, just like counted towards me.
You know, automatically.
Like, zero waste. I grew up in Portland.
Yeah. Even our feminine products are reusable and so on. So we thought that we were going to go into this thinking like, this will be a breeze. We'll just live our normal lives. But it really improved our lives.
Yeah. Really. What was it about it specifically?
I mean, for me, I had not been a composter until living by this book. I sort of thought of it as something people did who had space in their yard, you know, to have a big compost heap. And this book made it much more approachable. She has a whole section for like how to compost in a small apartment.
Which
I have
is
a little
so
container
important.
Now. Mm-hmm. I keep it in the freezer, which I learned from the book and Kristen.
And one thing I really loved about the book actually is I think that there are a lot of us walking around in this world with some low grade or maybe even high grade anxiety about the state of the environment. And it can feel paralyzing. Like, what can I possibly do? I just feel useless. I am part of the problem. But I think because the book has so many simple little steps you can take every day, it can help you feel a little bit more relieved about the world and to feel like you're not just part of the problem.
Okay, so we talked about Zero Waste Home. Let's talk about, Jolenta, your next pick for good advice, which was A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance by Emma Gray.
Yes, yes. This is a great book if you are most likely a woman, and felt sort of maligned or disappointed by the 2016 election. That's Emma Gray's into like, how do we enact actual change now that we're a group of just really angry, vocal women? Because protests only go so far. And what I really liked about this book was not only its sort of crash course in history of feminism vibe, but also it pointed out the importance of just finding and creating safe spaces.
But tell me what a safe space is.
Right.
That's not, I think it's one of those things that's gotten like, you know, people make fun of those,
right,
that terminology.
Like, this is a safe space. Right, like, this workplace is safe. Ha ha ha. Like,
what does
we're
it
all
mean?
Wimps.
Like, how and why did it resonate with you?
Just means a place where, you know, you can hang out with some like-minded people who are most likely, you know, fighting the same fight as you. It's a place where you don't have to explain where you're coming from, a place where the crushing reality of the world and sort of what you're up against is able to fall away, and you're able to remember like, oh, I'm not alone in this fight, even though I'm the only woman at my workplace or in my family who thinks this way, which is important because I think we forget how lonely it can feel to feel like you're like going up against the man.
Yeah, that's a pretty lonely feeling. I've been there. Now let's talk about bad advice, because you guys have also read some pretty bad stuff. Kristen, you had a meditation guide that didn't really resonate with you.
Yeah, this is a book called Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics by Dan Harris.
I fit the profile.
You love to meditate.
No, I'm a fidgety skeptic.
Oh, you
skeptic,
are.
Yeah.
I hate meditating.
Yeah,
I
can't do it.
I absolutely cannot stand it. It does not bring me joy. Mm-mm. It brings me frustration. It brings me irritation. And I absolutely hate any book that is written from the position of all people must do A, B, C.
In order to find X, Y, Z, right?
Yeah. Yes. And mm-hmm. in the case of this book, not A, B, C, but just A. Everybody must do A over and over and over again. And I was so irritated by his preaching about it, but then also how he practiced it in his own life seemed like a horrible example to follow. But I know that he's wildly popular. I know a lot of people get a great deal out of meditating. I know that his book is one of the most nominated books we've ever lived by on our show.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We faced a lot of heat for not vibing with it.
Are you kidding? For being able to complete a 2-hour meditation?
I always say meditation fanatics have no chill when it comes to defending meditation.
And if you love meditating, go for it. I'm all out here applauding for you. If that's what you want to do, go for it. But please don't tell me I have to do it too.
Wow. I won't mess with the people who meditate.
Mm-mm, never.
All right. Jolenta, what about you? You had some choices that you said were just bad advice.
Right. A recent book we read was Girl, Wash Your Face by Rachel Hollis. And it's supposed to be like hip young advice, like, girl, wash your face. But the whole premise of the book is that we are unhappy because we are lying to ourselves about certain things, and we're choosing to believe those lies as just the truth, the way of the world. And it sounds good on paper, but a whole book about, you know, don't lie to yourself about this area of your life and that area of your life. Like, stop saying you're bad at sex. Stop saying you're a lazy mom. Like, these are all lies. It's a negative vibe.
It's not positive reinforcement.
Yeah, it's very blamey, yeah. Which mm-hmm. then gets into the territory of just, you're only unhappy because you're lying to yourself, and it's all some mental trick.
Right.
And it totally discounts things in our lives we can't control that make us unhappy, you know? Different institutions and biases we have baked into our culture, that's not an individual person's fault if they feel like their happiness is sort of bumping up against, you know, sexism, racism, classism, like anything.
All the isms.
Yes.
Now, there are people who are going to pick up a lot of the books that you've already lived, pick up some of the books that you all are going to be looking at this coming season. So the question is, how does somebody decide what's good advice or what's bad advice from those books?
Pay close attention when you're reading the book. What strikes you the wrong way? What sounds like it's laying down an absolutism? Because there's no such thing as absolutes when it comes to living your best life. Everybody's different. And what works for one person isn't going to work for everyone. Not everybody's life is going to be better by waking up at 4 a.m. in the morning, for example, even if one book claims it. And the adherents of that book may want to believe it, but there's somebody like me then who's just going to be a rageaholic all day. So it doesn't work for everybody.
If you're up at 4 a.m.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. I would just say, remember, regardless of what kind of book you're reading by whatever kind of self-proclaimed expert they are, like, you are an expert in yourself and your life and how it works. And you can definitely take away good advice. You know, I will forever fold my socks differently after having read The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. But I'm not going to do all the stuff she does. You're allowed to pick and choose. You're not like a bad life improver if you don't take it all on.
And on that note, Jolenta Greenberg and Kristen Meinzer are the host of the Buy the Book podcast. Jolenta is also a comedian, and Kristen is the author of the forthcoming book, So You Want to Start a Podcast. Thanks so much, ladies.
Thanks so much for having us.
And that's your takeaway for today. Thanks so much for being with us. And of course, give us a call about anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. See you next time.